This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
You gotta see the baby. When are you gonna see the baby?
Family Matters.
You are listening to Family Matters here on Joy 94.9. And tonight on Family Matters, we're doing something a little bit different. A little bit different than our light-hearted look at parenthood. And to join us on this slightly different topic that we're dying to share with you all, I have the lovely Beck.
I've been called lovely twice tonight, and that's the first time in my life, so I'm writing that down.
I meant it. And joining the lovely Beck and myself is a voice you might have heard just a moment ago, the very lovely Steph from Stand Up Straight.
Hello, Gina. Thank you for having me on Family Matters. This is
exciting.
Great.
We love visitors.
We do love visitors, and we've actually adopted you for not only this week, but for next week as well, because here we are hoping, we're very much hoping to lay the platitudes and rest to bed the cliches and have a very frank discussion about end-of-life care and death care this week and next week. Now, we've been really fortunate for you to join us, Steph, and help curate this topic of death and dying. You've brought together an amazing array of guests and an amazing array of knowledge. And I'll let you, when we get back from this track, give us a little background where your knowledge has come from. But if you do have any questions for us during this show or during the week, you can reach out to us on Twitter at Family Matters 94, Facebook, which is Family Matters on Joy. You can send us an email, familymatters@joy.org.au. And just to remind the audience, if any of the material tonight is upsetting, you can always contact Lifeline 24/7 on 131114. Well, you are listening to Family Matters. We are a light-hearted show, but we're taking a little bit of a twist the next couple of weeks where we are actually looking at the topic of dying and death. Lovely Steph from Stand Up Straight. Steph, you have helped us curate an amazing array of guests for the next couple of weeks while we explore this topic. Do you want to maybe give the audience a bit of background as to why you're the right person that should be in this room today?
All right. Well, I think, Jeannie, you and I had a conversation a couple of months back about a funeral service that I'd led, and you were particularly interested in that service. And we talked about death not discriminating and a few other things. And, you know, my work as a celebrant leads me all over Melbourne, and I meet some really interesting people, interesting families. And it is a topic that some people don't want to talk about, but more and more people are becoming very interested in. And in fact, on the 8th of August, next Tuesday, there is a national day, Dying to Know Day, which is all about, it's a day dedicated to bringing to life conversations and community action around death and dying. And it's going to be recognised here in Melbourne and all across Australia. And that was really the catalyst for bringing together this show. All of a sudden there was a deadline there. Excuse the pun. But
you can hear a lot of that.
There was a reason to work towards this project. And I started making a list of all the people that I really wanted to talk to around this, because there are some very interesting people here in Australia and also in the States who are trying to demystify death. And
I'll be honest, we first chatted about this because I have this fear of being buried a certain way in my faith, because we know death doesn't discriminate, but people do, and faiths do. And we're seeing this in the marriage equality debate about, you know, religious exemptions. And for me, the biggest fear is death equality and making sure I'm recognised there. And that's how we started this conversation. I had a slight fear at the beginning. Oh, my God, we're a lighthearted show. This might be really dark topics, but my goodness, the interviews have been some of the most uplifting interviews I've probably listened to. And it's actually all about celebrating life. Like that was the one thing I kept getting at the end of all these clips. This is actually everyone's saying here, celebrate life, focus on what really matters and go for it. Don't wait for that final reminder of, well, what are you going to do now? You've got a month or a couple of weeks to live. Like it was just all about celebrating life.
Yeah. In the planning for death and, you know, end of life, you often and I know this as a celebrant. I mean, I have a heightened sense of gratitude because every single day I am reminded that I'm here and I'm so lucky to be here. And, you know, I'm fortunate in that I have those reminders, but I think, you know, when people do start to plan for their end of life, it does remind them that, you know, there is so much living to be done and just don't take it for granted and get yourself organised.
Beck, how are you in this sort of space?
I'm really pleased to be a part of this because I am terrible at death, like terrible. Like it frightens me.
But Beck, you lost your grandfather only, what, 2 months ago? Yeah. And I know that that was a really big event in your life and it really knocked you for six.
Yeah, I find death really terrifying and I find talking about it terrifying and I find talking to people about, without getting too deep, we had friends of ours that lost two babies quite a few years ago. And I remember my mum saying to me, we're going around to see them. And I got so distressed. And I said to mum, I can't go. Yeah. I was about 15. I said, I can't go because I don't know what to say to them. And mum said, it's not about you. It's about them. Just be there. And it was this really interesting kind of lesson for me about how terrified I was to talk to them about it. So I'm really excited about these interviews because I think I'm really going to learn something from it.
Yeah.
But I was reminded of, we were talking, Jenna and I, earlier about kids at funerals, and I had this memory of when my grandma died. This is 25 years ago. My younger cousin was about 5 and he got up on the altar because all the kids were there, got up on the altar and everyone was like, get down, get down. And he just yelled out from the altar, is Grandma behind that curtain? And we're like, okay, that's his perception, that Grandma's just popped behind. And it was just a really interesting, you know, I'm interested in your thoughts on kids at funerals because I know a lot of people say, oh, you shouldn't have them there, you shouldn't have them around death.
I think it is always up to the parents. But if the parents are asking me my opinion, I will always suggest that they bring their children. But I always suggest that, and it depends on how old the kids are. I mean, I had kids at a funeral service today ranging from 5 through to about 12. There were four children. And it was a memorial service, but they had been part of a funeral service the day before. So the kids had been very involved in the whole process of the funeral. But you know, I think it's really important to make kids feel involved and included. So I will do little things like, you know, I just think that kids love a little job that most of them don't want to get up and speak or say anything. It's terrifying for most people. But I'll give them a little job. You know, today they were lighting candles, so they each had a little taper that they had to light. And then after the service, when the service was over, you know, I gave them extra tapers and I said, this is one to light for next week, this same time next week, and here's another one to light for this time next year. So just kind of building in little rituals that they're able to do and just opportunities for them to be involved and then to talk about their grandfather or whoever it is that they've lost.
And that's the thing, most of us either learn, I mean, I lost a grandparent. That was the first time I experienced death as a kid. Nobody explained anything to me.
No.
And nobody explained that in a Greek service it's an open casket. And that was traumatic.
Yeah.
And yes, I was young, but a heads up would have been really nice.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, I always speak to the parents before and I say, over the next few days, talk a lot about the service. But the big thing that I find that most kids get upset about is them seeing grown-ups crying.
Yeah.
So you need to say to kids, look, a funeral service is a sad occasion. It can sometimes be a really happy occasion too, but oftentimes you will see people upset and you'll see grown-ups crying, and that's okay because that's what we do at a funeral service. So just preparing kids, you know, I always get kids to come into the chapel earlier or wherever we are earlier so I can, explain to them what I'm going to do, what I'm going to say, and, you know, get any questions from them.
That's a great idea, actually.
I think it's all about, and that kind of desensitizes them a little bit. I mean, coffins are very confronting for everybody. and especially little kids, and they're always interested in the coffin. What's in the coffin? What's going on inside the coffin?
So, in a Greek one, they kind of open it. It's really disturbing. Not great for a little kid that doesn't know. That's what, how you're going to say bye to grandpa.
But I don't think that's such a bad thing if you've been prepared for it, because I've done services for Greek families, and you know, there's nothing nicer than seeing a grandchild kiss a grandparent and not have that icky, squirmy feeling, oh, my goodness, it's a dead body. I mean, the Greeks are particularly good at
mourning.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it's art form of it. We make, you know, we've got, for us, I think the service itself, I've spoken to you many times, Steph, I'm really not a fan of the service, and that's one of the things that I'm really fearful of, because if I was to be buried in a Greek Orthodox service, it wouldn't mention my partner, wouldn't mention my sexuality, wouldn't mention me, because it's busy talking about sin. Some of the custom stuff, I love the food and the way we take care of each other. Mm. I love that about my Greek culture. We do things for 40 days. We believe that the Spirit is with us for 40 days. So that's a real time of reflection and saying goodbye. Like, that stuff I love. But then, you know, we continue, you know, 40 days, 3 months, 6 months, 12. Like, it's the person is always amongst us in that space. But yeah, for kids, I sort of sometimes feel sorry for the kids, because nobody talks to them about this and gets them ready.
Talk to your kids.
Talk
prepare
to your
them.
Kids. Look, we are here on Family Matters. We are starting a series this week, Dying to Tell, all about death and dying. And if you have any questions, please message us here on 0427-JOY-949. You are listening to Family Matters here on Joy 94.9, and tonight and next week we are looking at a slightly different topic than parenthood. We have a series called Dying to Know, and joining me in the studio tonight, I've got the lovely Beck and the lovely Steph.
Now, the first interview we're going to listen to tonight is two women who are very involved in Dying to Know Day. Jessie William, who is the executive director of the Groundswell Project, who are a big supporter of Dying to Know Day, and also Helen Callanan, who is a doula and a founder of an organisation called Preparing the Way. So we're going to have a little listen to this interview, and then I'm hoping we'll talk a little bit about it after. On the 8th of August, the fifth Dying to Know Day, a national annual day of action dedicated to bringing to life conversations and community action around death and dying, will be recognised here in Melbourne and across Australia with a series of events. Here to talk with us about Dying to Know Day and some of these events, I have on the line Jessie Williams, the Executive Director of the Groundswell Project, and here in the studio, Helen Callanan, a doula and founder of Preparing the Way. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Jessie and Helen, you have partnered to put together an event for Dying to Know Day. But firstly, let's talk a little bit about your different roles and organisations and how Dying to Know Day came about. So let's begin with you, Jessie, as you're in Sydney. Can you explain the aims of the Groundswell Project and how and why you became involved?
Yeah, certainly. Thank you for having us, Stephanie. Look, the Groundswell Project was formed by two extraordinary women 7 years ago. So I wonder if I could tell the genesis story and then perhaps the context of why we exist.
Yes.
So we were founded by Peter Murray, who's a celebrated Australian playwright based in Melbourne, and Kerry Noonan, who's a clinical psychologist who works in palliative care in Sydney. And they were both at a health conference, and the usual conversation was going on about why Australians aren't planning for end of life, aren't sharing their wishes with their loved ones. But there was a sense that there was this othering going on, that it was other people's problem that they weren't doing that. There was not an inquiry around why are we so poorly equipped at talking about death and talking about our end of life plans. So Peter and Kerry said, well, we've got to do this differently. We've got to do death differently in the West. So the Groundswell Project was born, and we were really founded with this idea that we really want to develop creative and profound ways of engaging with death as an everyday part of life, because indeed it has always been a part of life. It's always been a part of the human experience. For 200,000 years, we have died in our communities and in our homes. But something changed, and something changed around the turn of the century when your grandmother's grandmother was alive. We, of course, developed some incredible medical advancements that meant that we were living better and longer. We were managing chronic disease. We were managing infection. But as a result of that, the good stuff that came out of that meant that we actually started to outsource our death and dying. We outsourced it to the aged care industry, we outsourced it to hospitals, and we outsourced it to the funeral industry. And so the impact of that for us now as a society is that we've really had two or three generations of people where we have not grown up seeing, sensing, smelling, touching death. So it's really quite a surprise when it happens. And that's the context that we exist in. That's why Groundswell was born. We are an arts health organization. We're national. And we're really here to amplify what we see as a social movement to bring death and dying back into our communities and indeed demedicalize the dying experience to the extent that people want it to be demedicalized.
And I guess destigmatize it too.
Absolutely. So we love to do social polls, and we asked on Facebook last year, is referring to the topic of death as taboo helpful? And actually the insights that came to us in the conversations in community was that if you can say something's taboo, it's actually not taboo, right? Something that's really taboo will not even get discussed on Facebook. So we don't think it's taboo. We do understand that it's a bit weird, and we do understand that it can be a bit nerve-wracking, but we find the minute someone cracks open that nut, everyone wants to talk and you can't shut them up.
Helen, you are a doula. Tell us, who is a doula and what do they do?
I was originally from the Greek, as you say, and I think originally was pronounced thule. Originally was translated as slave. However, we've come to use it now as like a person of service. So a doula is a non-medical role, and they provide support, options, resources to someone, and traditionally they're around birth, but of course it's majorly in the end-of-life world now as well. In the UK, US and Canada, end-of-life doulas are really quite prevalent, and it's an emerging industry here in Australia. And really it's about, to me, having a doula is having someone walk alongside you on your journey, whatever that is for you, in your culture, in your tradition, and supporting you by letting you know what choices there are, what options there are, and then supporting you fulfilling those. It's not about a doula rowing their own boat, right? They're here to have your back and support you, doing what it is in your family and your needs and helping meet those.
So why are we so afraid of talking about death? And I know Jesse touched on medicalization and, you know, sort of the over-sterilization of the whole funeral and death care process. Mm. What do you think, why we are so afraid of talking about death?
For me, what I see is that people have, and if you like, here in Australia in particular, I'll speak about that, you know, we have a she'll be right, mate. We don't want to be a burden. We have all of these attitudes, and it's like, if I don't talk about it, it won't happen. You know, it's almost like a superstitious thing, rather than people getting real and going, you know what, I don't know anyone who's got out of here without dying. You know, it's coming our way for every single one of us. So I think it's a lot of internal questions, and I'm sure Jesse, I'd love to hear what Jesse's, you know, got to say about that too. But I see a lot of it as being personal fear that has become cultural, and it's become a habit.
Oh, yeah, echoing everything Helen has said. I also think the paradox is that there's a belief that we notice in our workshops that comes through, which is if I talk about it, it will happen. So there's an opposite superstition. And honestly, I think loss and grief and sadness are uncomfortable emotions. We all know what our daily lives are like in this world right now, and it's this, they're stuffed full of ideas and thoughts and things, usually sort of past focused or future focused, but not necessarily present focused. And to be in the present means to feel feelings, and to feel feelings means to feel loss, and to feel loss is uncomfortable. So I think that is how I would sort of unpack some of those reservations that we have. But as Helen said, when we invite people to talk about death, we're actually inviting people to talk about their mortality. And when we invite people to talk about their mortality, what comes to life is the richness of our relationships, the depth of our love, the appreciation we have for being alive. And that is the juicy bit. That's kind of almost feels like a secret, that what we call the deathies, the people who, you know, really lean into this conversation, need to share more, that it's actually a very delicious conversation, and it brings into light just how you are living your life, and then you make the most of it, right? You enhance it.
So, Jesse, how do you start this conversation?
You just do it, huh? You know, we get asked at Groundswell a lot from bureaucrats in health, how do we get people to talk? And our answer is always the same, just do it. You got to have the ovaries big enough sometimes just to do it, but just do it. And so we model this. So, for example, I talk about death in a corporate environment. We run this program called The Compassionate Workplace. I run workshops at 7:30 in the morning for, you know, sometimes it's a room of bankers talking about death and dying over coffee and croissants in a high-towered building before they start their day. At 7:30 in the morning, I welcome them and I say, we're going to talk about death. Crack. Done, let's do it. And everybody starts talking in a big way.
In 2016 on Dying to Know Day, there were events that involved dinners and storytelling, webinars, afternoon teas. What's planned for this year? And specifically, what have you planned together at Federation Square here in Melbourne?
So, you know, we never know what's going to happen for Dying to Know Day. We never know what the community is going to come up with. So what Groundswell's purpose is we launch the day on social media. We develop some communication tools, so some posters, some memes, some words to really kind of, you know, I suppose disrupt a fairly ageist view of death and dying. So we call it the wrinkly hands approach, you know, not that there's anything wrong with wrinkly hands, but we want to bring quirk into it. We want to bring fun into it. So the strap line for this year is, what if talking about death didn't even raise an eyebrow? So we then give all of those tools to the community and the community come up with the ideas for the events. At the moment, they're being, you know, registering. We see the ticker going up each day. More and more events are coming online and we're always dying to see what ideas are coming forth.
As I said earlier, preparing the way, our biggest commitment is around all people, and that's a capital A, capital L, capital L, all people.
We love that here at Joy.
Exactly. having choice and options and empowered around end of life and everything that entails. So I approached them about, like, let's do something. Let's create something big in Melbourne, right? And so Fed Square, to me, it's so iconic. It's in the centre of Melbourne and apparently is the site of a Aboriginal meeting place originally. And I think it was also the home of the first city morgue, you know, so it's literally like got some history there. So what we've created is the biggest ever single Dying to Know Day event. And so it's on August the 8th at Fed Square, goes from 10 a.m. until 6:30 p.m. We're going to have like up to 30 people exhibiting. So things around educational things, you know, we might have some beautiful wicker caskets there, like things for people to go, wow, did you even know this exists, you know? Mm-hmm. Sustainability and environmentally friendly stuff is important to people now. What options are out there? So really a day of education. We're going to have the, looks like we're having the Threshold Choir. They're going to come because they actually go into hospitals and things and sing for people who are close at end of life. And they're going to use that as a we're going to have demonstrations of that. We're going to have Peter's Hawk is coming to speak with people. We're going to have other celebrities talking. We're going to have a stage set up with, you know, a screen above it. And we're just going to have a massive day of conversation. But you know what? Both I'm really big about that, you know, I'm really over the Grim Reaper stuff and all of that dark and scary stuff. Because to me, death's not that. I've been around it way too much. Death is actually a beautiful time of privilege and of rare, precious time, you know. And so, and it's about life. You know, death to me is a part of life. It's not some singular event. And we want to celebrate life at Dying to Know Day and having people have options and know everything so that they can live as they choose right up until that last breath.
You are listening to Family Matters on Joy 94.9 with Beck, Gina, and our special guest, Steph. Thank you for joining us, Steph.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our topic tonight is my greatest fear, to talk about death. So I am learning already, which is brilliant. Steph, that was a fascinating interview.
Have your ovaries, what was that?
Big enough ovaries to talk about death. That's what I learned.
Love that line. Have you got big enough ovaries now, Beck, to talk about death?
They're growing. I can feel them growing inside me.
Good girl. Mm.
You know, we thought we were coming in to hear a little bit about Dying to Know You Day, which starts next week. But they were just amazing.
They were amazing. And that is just a short snippet. Clip of yeah. a much longer interview that we are going to upload onto our
podcast. Absolutely. Yeah. So tonight you're going to be hearing little snippets of these interviews. They're much longer interviews. They're absolutely fabulous interviews, and we've been really fortunate that we will have them up as individual podcasts, and then the full tonight series will be up as well. And you can get that on our podcast, which is Family Matters on Joy. You know, go to Joy's website, go to Family Matters, you'll find our podcast.
iTunes.
You can download us on iTunes and get them there as they start getting dropped into that little podcast drop box.
So we have started the conversation about death, and moving on from there, we are going to do something really practical.
This appeals to the lawyer.
Yes, lawyer in the room. And you, the next person you will be hearing from is actually a lawyer.
Yes.
Because we've got fantastic legislation here in Victoria. And in March 2018, the Medical Treatment Planning and Decisions Bill, which was passed in November last year, will come into effect, which is going to give people a whole lot more control over their end of life. And we've been really fortunate to have had great support from the Office of the Public Advocate and a senior legal officer there, Claire McNamara, who gave us a lot of her time. And again, this is just a short clip a much longer interview. And what she is talking about is really important stuff. So have a listen to this. So what has your involvement been with the initial inquiry into end-of-life choices?
Well, I think the Office of the Public Advocate has been interested in the issue of future planning, not just in relation to healthcare, but all sorts of other matters that anyone, any adult really should contemplate, that in the future they may not be capable of making decisions or doing things for themselves, and considering how they might try to inform what would happen if that was to be their circumstance. So in particular in relation to healthcare, because as I mentioned before, we get many calls from people wanting to know who they could appoint to be, well, the language now will be medical treatment decision maker, so probably easiest just to use that terminology, but also from hospitals about who can make decisions when somebody lacks capacity. And of course, for the guardians in the office, that's what they've been asked to do, and it's a very difficult role for a decision maker to fulfil if they don't know what the patient themselves wants. And that's why part of our education strategy and message for some time has been to encourage people who are currently competent to think about what their values and preferences are and communicate those to other people. We're also aware that the various laws that have been existing in Victoria for a period of time are perhaps more complex than they needed to be, and some different legislative terminology and different acts. And we thought, and the government clearly agreed, that things could be simplified, and that's probably one of the main achievements of the Medical Treatment Planning and Decisions Act, that will have a standalone piece of legislation rather than the cluster of legislation that exists at the moment. So we were interested in law reform for simplicity, and also to create the opportunity to make it clearer to people that this is an area of human rights and the expression of autonomy. The language from legislation in the past talks about substitute decision makers making decisions in somebody's best interests, which many people would find rather paternalistic language. And the new Act picks up much more consistently with a modern discourse around human rights. And the idea is now that people will be able to hope, well, they will choose someone who would make the decision that they would make if competent. So it's much more respectful of the idea of autonomy.
Okay. So with that in mind, Claire, what conversations do people need to be having around end-of-life choices, and with whom should they be having them?
Well, I guess it depends how real end of life is for somebody in their imagination. I mean, it might be completely speculative because it's something that will happen to all of us, or it might be something very real because you've got a diagnosis or you're of a certain age and you have, you know, a number of health conditions. So I guess it depends very much where you are in relation to that. But without sort of seeming to be too fatalistic, thinking about end of life is probably something that's good for anyone to do, to contemplate who would be there to make decisions for them, and how would people know what you want. So you need to communicate with the people that you think would make decisions for you, your family members who care about you. You need to keep in mind the people perhaps you wouldn't want involved in that, and how you would make sure that they were excluded. You need to speak to your health practitioners. In the same way as if you're making any sort of medical treatment decision for yourself at the moment, you need to be really informed. And so knowing that you may not be the person, and as you indicated, something like 50% of people or more won't be able to make their own decisions as they near the end of life, you really want to equip the people who are going to be part of that conversation to know what your voice is.
Perhaps you can explain what an advance care plan is, and when a person should put together an advance care plan, perhaps, you know, let people know where they can begin with that.
Sure. Well, lots of different terminology is used, but if I'm thinking about advance care planning, I'm thinking about it quite broadly. And the ways anyone would do their advance care plan depends very much upon their own unique circumstances. So any individual would think about what their family circumstances are, what their values are, what their fears are, what their current health condition is, what their experience of health conditions or the health system has been, whether in relation to themselves or to other people. But there are common elements. So the way I would see it is, the first thing is really have some private contemplation, and then the next stage would be to discuss with the people that you think are important, to have those discussions with, whether it's health practitioners or whether it's your family. Certainly with discussions with family and friends and partners and so on, it can be very informal. And then the next stage to contemplate is whether you need to document anything. And that might be very important. And documentation really is a process, in my view, that follows discussion. So you don't start by filling out forms. You start by thinking and discussing. And then you might get to the point where you want to document that. And there are number of health organisations have some different formats, and as I say, there's different terminology. So some health organisations might call them statement of choices, or health practitioners might call them goals of care. If you do document something, you then want to make sure you store those documents with whoever they need to belong to. And the documents could consist of, you might fill out a formal document which is about appointing someone to be your medical treatment decision maker. So those forms currently you can do that, and the law will change next year and there'll be some different forms, but it doesn't matter when you appointed someone on what form you used, it will continue to be valid even when the law changes. And you might also document your preferences and values, or you might be really specific about some sort of treatment. You might say, I do want to have all life-sustaining treatment, or you might say, there are treatments that I wouldn't want if I'd got to a certain progression of my disease. You might use language like, I want comfort measures, or I want all treatment that's available. I want all of that. It's entirely, as I say, it's unique really to everyone. And, you know, perhaps, you know, when I think about it for myself, what my advanced care planning consists of, given my circumstances, is I've appointed my partner to be my medical treatment decision maker, and my partner is aware of my wishes. And for me at the moment, that's really all I feel I need to do. But at a future point in time, I might do something more and document things. But that's not what I feel I need to do at the moment. So I wouldn't want people to feel that everyone's got to come out with the same look of advanced care planning, because people need to develop something that is that meets their particular needs.
So Claire, if people don't do advanced care planning, what would happen? And, you know, I'm thinking around people who perhaps have got, you know, breakdowns in their family, or perhaps there may be people in the trans community who are transitioning later in life who are looking for their wishes to be met. Can you perhaps paint a picture of, you know, what that scenario may look like?
Sure. So one of the key planks of advanced care planning is choosing who you want to be your medical treatment decision maker. So you can choose anyone you want who's over the age of 18, and it doesn't need to be a family member. It'd be a person that you would trust to respect your wishes. If you don't choose to do that, the way the law operates is that if you're not capable of making a decision for yourself, a health practitioner needs to obtain consent from someone. So the legislation provides for what I would call a default medical treatment decision maker. So not the person of your choosing, but who the law deems will be that person. And it follows ordinary sort of blood family lines. So parent, adult, child, sibling. And it might be for people in the GLBTQI community that the relationships they have with those particular family members don't necessarily represent who they would trust to make significant decisions for them. So all the more reason to be thinking about appointing someone to be your medical treatment decision maker, because if you're incapacitated and nobody knows that you had a that your sister doesn't respect your particular wishes, she's going to be the one that the law might be looking to make decisions for you. So that's true in relation to any type of health or medical issue that a person has, but there might be some very specific types of experiences that people in the community have that they really wouldn't want perhaps family members to know about, or, for instance, people who might be transitioning. There might be some very specific wishes they have that they wouldn't be able to trust a family member to respect. So, again, they're the sort of circumstances where advanced care planning is really critical to ensuring that your wishes are respected at a point when you can't speak for yourself, or well, you might still be able to speak for yourself, but you may be deemed not to have capacity to be providing consent to medical treatment. And apart from medical treatment, more broadly, if you're thinking about advanced planning more broadly, who you would want to be present perhaps at end of life, there might be people you do want there, there might be people that you don't want there, and they're the sort of matters that you could address in an advanced care plan.
Claire, families have changed so much over the past 50 years. How do you think our understanding of death has changed?
Well, that's a hard one for me as a lawyer to answer, because I guess I can only really draw on my sense of living in a Western sanitised sort of world where death is something that most of us don't actually observe, and that's probably a reasonably modern phenomenon. So death has become somewhat hidden, and what we're trying to do with this process is at least bring the discussion out more openly, so that people aren't scared, prepared to have those sort of conversations. And the stakes are different with blended families because the lines of communication will be very specific to the way the families have organised themselves, and people may not necessarily, one individual might be in contact with many members of their family, but those lines of communication don't flow through other members of the family. So you sort of need to work out how are you going to try to manage those who you want to bring together at a point when you're not the one who's necessarily in control anymore.
This is Family Matters with our slightly different take, I guess, on families tonight. Talking dying to know and a lot about death. And it's just been so interesting. I'm Beck and I'm here with Gina and our special guest, Steph. Now, Steph, Claire, talking about advanced care plans, what an important concept.
Such an important concept. And we are so fortunate in Victoria to have legislation around that now, which, as I said, will come into effect in March 2018. But it just gives everybody the opportunity to document how they want their end of life to play out, really. And look, we will post on our website some links that people can go to, because there's an amazing amount of information and government-provided information on advanced care planning with templates so you can fill in an advanced care plan. And but most importantly, you know, as Claire said, just get the conversation started before you start filling in your forms. Start talking to people, you know, the people that you want to know.
And those podcasts as well will have all the links to specifically to the services that Claire's office offers.
Molly Carlisle has an extensive clinical background in specialist palliative care nursing, counselling and education. As a leader in her field, Molly has held a variety of regional, state and national positions in the healthcare sector. She is a member of the Order of Australia and the recipient of many other awards, including the Minister's Award for Outstanding Achievement by an individual or team in healthcare. She is a Churchill Fellow and a National Ambassador for Dying to Know Day. Welcome, Molly.
Thanks, Stephanie. It's lovely to be here.
Yeah, and thank you for joining us on Joy 94.9. Molly, let's begin with Dying to Know Day. When did you first become involved, and why do you think it's an important initiative?
The Groundswell Project established Dying to Know Day in 2013, and it grew out of the people who established the Groundswell Project were arts and health people. I was in the arts and health sort of
space. They were looking at how we could better get communities talking about death and dying and grief. And they approached me and said, would you be an ambassador? And, of course, I jumped at it because I think that's really important too. So I've been involved since the very first year.
And what are some of the events that you've attended over the years?
Well, the first year, at the time I was working at Austin Health at the Olivia Newton-John Cancer Centre, I actually am really lucky because Olivia's a really good friend of mine now, and we talk to each other regularly and email regularly. Anyone who's read my last book would see that Olivia wrote the foreword because she really gets it. But at the time, she was very focused on the cure for cancer pathway. When I started talking to her about, you know, sometimes people don't get better and it's not their fault, and it's not because they didn't try hard enough or anything else. It's just because the illness is the illness. Sometimes you don't get better. She really grabbed onto that and ran with it. So the first year we did a huge event at the Cancer Centre that was, we set up a lounge room in the foyer of the Cancer Centre. We built this huge fireplace and we had an armchair and a lamp and a rug, and we invited people to come in and talk about the things that were important to them in their lives and about death. And we thought we'd get probably, I don't know, 10 or 11 people to come and sit in the chair and talk. And we had, you know, a film crew and stuff there. Well, we thought we'd go for 2 hours. We went for four, and there were people queuing up to sit in the chair and talk. And there was a huge, like, the audience just grew because everyone was really enthralled with the stories people told. To me, that said, you know what? Even these people who are here having cancer treatment, who are hoping they're going to get better, want to talk about this stuff. It really reinforced the message for me that it doesn't matter what station you have in life, what cultural background you come from, you know, what your family situation is, what your socioeconomic situation is. Death is the thing that we all have to face one day, and everyone thinks about it, but no one talks about it. And that's what Dying to Know Day is all about, just giving people a platform or an avenue to talk about the things that they're too scared to talk about in their own private circle.
So, Molly, if it is as simple as providing a forum for people, what are some of the forums that the organisation are providing around the event on the 8th of August?
There's people doing all sorts of things, and our team did their first ever Dying to Know Day last year. We put a big, huge bucket up out the front of, like a cut-out bucket out the front of the office, and we asked people to write down the things that were important to them and stick them in the bucket. This year, our staff, and I've stepped right back from it this year, I've encouraged the staff to run with it. So we've got a really big clinical team who are going to Fountain Gate Shopping Centre and setting up a stall, and they're going to talk to ordinary folk who are there going to do their shopping or taking the kids to, you know, McDonald's or whatever, and trying to just raise awareness, get people to think about the import. It's not just about dying, Stephanie. It's not just about that. It's about, if you think about your death, then it enables you to think about what the important things are in your life and focus on those things, because we all get so distracted by the high pace and the high level of, like, we all work so hard and the weekend comes and we're running around doing stuff. If you thought about, if I had 3 months to live, would I be doing what I'm doing right now? A lot of people say, you know what, I wouldn't be doing this. I'd be doing something else. Really, Dying to Know Day is about living. It's about getting people to think about what are the important things in their life and how can they invest more time and energy on the stuff that matters, rather than getting caught in this treadmill of stuff that doesn't really matter, and then getting a diagnosis and going, oh my God, I didn't do all the stuff I wanted to do. That's what Dying to Know Day is all about.
So let's talk about some of the tools that we can use with making some plans, and I know that you're a big advocate for having a death plan, which really is probably a life plan more than a death plan. Can you explain what a death plan is and what it perhaps should include?
A death plan is about, if someone said to me, I've got 3 months to live, what would be the things that I really wanted to get done in that 3 months, and where would I want to die, and how would that happen, and who would be there, and what would happen afterwards? So my view about this is not only about the dying bit, it's about the afterwards bit. And people often forget that piece of the puzzle. People think, oh yeah, I'll tell my eldest child that, you know, I want to be buried, not cremated, and I want to go here and I want to have this sort of funeral. But what they don't understand is that once they die, their body becomes the property of the executor of their will. So if the executor of your will is a lawyer, he can make a decision about what happened, and it may be the total opposite of what you wanted. If you step back from that point, this is where having the conversations early is so important. Because if you have those conversations with the people around you, then it doesn't get to a point where you're dying and, you know, a long-lost family member arrives on the scene and starts making decisions over the top of those who you've invested with your thoughts and your values and all of that. I've seen that happen so many times where someone who hasn't been engaged in the network arrives and says, no, we're doing this. And the person who's dying has no say about it. Having the conversations, writing that stuff down, means you have more control over what happens with your dying and then after your death.
As a palliative care expert, what changes, Molly, have you noticed in our understanding of death, particularly over the last 10 years, as I think that we are becoming better at talking about it?
I think we are. And I think, to me, Stephanie, that the important thing is that we demedicalise the whole dying thing. And that doesn't mean you pull apart a really good system of palliative care and open it up to the market. Because there is certainly a move from the recent Productivity Commission report talks about competition and a user choice and all of that stuff. If you're 2 months off dying and someone says to you, you can choose out of these five services, like, you're not in a place to make a choice. And most people haven't even talked about what those choices could be up until that point. So there's that end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum is local communities are starting to say, you know what, the lady next door to me is not really well. How can I help out? The compassionate communities movement that really started here with Alan Kelleher from La Trobe University like 18 years ago, and that's all about getting local communities pulled together when someone's really sick. And it doesn't mean you have to go and wipe their bum or wash them in their bed or whatever else, but it means that someone's coordinating the fact that seven lamb casseroles don't turn up on the same day, and, you know, that the kids are picked up from school and the lawns are mowed and the person's taken to their doctor's appointment, and that the carer isn't left to do all of that stuff. For me, that's a really great leap forward.
And what happens, Molly, when an individual's wishes can't be met simply for practical reasons? You know, you may have somebody with a terminal illness who is at home and they have got a partner caring for them. The partner might be a female and might be, you know, slight and not well themselves and not physically able to take care of that person. You know, how compromised do you become then when you're not meeting their wishes and they do have to go into a care facility?
And look, Stephanie, that's a really good point because, you know, if you look at all of the research that's been done around unpaid carers and you look at the data that talks about average age of death in this country, by and large, a lot of people find themselves in the position where they become a carer all of a sudden when previously they've been the person who has had the chronic illness or who has had the disability or whatever else, and their partner's been the person looking after them. That is really common. Again, I go back to the whole idea of compassionate communities, because if you've got a mobilised community who can do the basic stuff
like meals, looking after the housework and shopping and appointments and stuff, then that means the carer can focus on doing what they're able to do with support of their local community. And it also means both the carer and the person who's dying don't all of a sudden become alienated from their normal network. But that won't happen until networks start to evolve that are informed and feel more confident about knocking on the door next door and saying, what can I do to help? Because people are scared of doing that because they're frightened of saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, so they don't do it. And that means the carer is usually left on their own trying to do everything when a lot of the time it's beyond their capability.
Molly, what is your most important message to people wanting to face immortality?
Just talk about it. You know, talking about death doesn't make you die quicker. You die when you're going to die. And all of us are going to die one day. You know, we talk about sex, we talk about, you know, driving, we do all of this stuff to keep us safe. This is just another way of keeping us safe, is to have these conversations, to be open about it. No matter how uncomfortable it is, it's reality. If you can put aside your own apprehensions to listen to someone else's views about what they value and what means, you know, what's the stuff that matters to them, then you're giving them a huge gift. And hopefully you get that gift in return.
Joy Sponsor, and we are Family Matters here on Joy 94.9, running completely out of time. And that was part one, just part one of the Dying to Tell series that we will be releasing in bigger form on podcasts that you can download from iTunes or pick up from the Joy Family Matters page. Beck, Steph, a minute to go. That was amazing. And there's so much more content in all those interviews.
Can't wait.
Yes. And next week, you've heard of sex ed. Next week, we talk to Dr. Zitta, who will be talking death ed. We've also got two of my favourite funeral professionals talking about the funeral profession. So please come back. Join us next week at 8 o'clock on Family Matters.
And next week, we are actually going to do a mashup of funeral songs. So if there is a funeral song out there want for yourself, or you'd never want to have played, let us know. Let us know throughout the week. Find us through all the usual channels, Facebook, Twitter, email, you name it. I've got my song ready that I'm going to mash up, and I'm sure Steph has got songs she never wants to hear played ever again. Is that right, Steph?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So thank you again for joining us. Have you got something to say to the lads next door, Beck?
Woof. Gravy is really nice on chips.
Really is, actually. Mm.
That's what I might have now after the show.
I know. Good night, everyone, and thank you for joining us for this first of, we hope, a much longer series called Dying to Tell. Good night.
You've been listening to Joy 94.9's Family Matters podcast, your light-hearted look at parenthood and rainbow families, sponsored by Berry Street. Did you know that Berry Street seeks members of our LGBTI communities to become foster carers? Not only do they have a proud tradition of training and embracing LGBTIQ carers, they officially support marriage equality. Learn more now at berrystreet.org.au, a proud Joy sponsor for over 5 years.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.